was the real Seneca? The moral philosopher or the power broker to the Roman emperor?
He was a devoted adherent of the Stoic creed, meaning that he tried to live a life of moral awareness with an emphasis on reason and the suppression of the passions and ambition. All that would lead him to live out his life in a library, but instead he chose to enter politics and rose to a very high position. He was advisor to Nero, so he had to live two very contradictory existences. One, a moral philosopher who seemed disinterested in power, and the other, very much a power monger.
That's historian James Rahm. His book is Dying Every Day, Seneca at the Court of Nero. And Nero and Seneca were the elite, but what about the ordinary Roman?
How did these ordinary Romans think about the world around them? How did they deal with life as they found it?
That's historian Robert Knapp. We talked to him about his book, Invisible Romans. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When we think of the word Stoic, we imagine the quality of bearing up under great adversity. But Stoicism, in its original meaning in ancient Rome, was a moral philosophy not unlike Buddhism that counseled simple living, reason over emotion, and indifference to fame and fortune. Yet its most famous practitioner, the philosopher and writer Seneca, lived anything but a simple life. He was fabulously rich, and as a senator and then advisor to the emperor Nero, he was a power broker of the first order. My guest, historian James Rahm, has written a fascinating book about Seneca, centering on the dilemma he faced when he became Nero's advisor. In it, Rahm tries to answer the question, how could the sage, who constantly exhorted his readers toward virtue and reason, have served as the right-hand man of a despot notorious for madness, repression, and family murder? Rahm's quest makes for a spellbinding read. It's called Dying Every Day, Seneca at the Court of Nero. James Rahm, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
This book, Dying Every Day, first of all, tell us what the title refers to.
Well, the title has a double meaning because it's actually a quote from Seneca's writings. He described human life as dying every day. He wrote, quotidie morimur, we are dying every day. As soon as we're born, we're on a journey toward the grave. That was his somewhat gloomy, stoic perspective on human life. But it also describes his own existence at the court of Nero. As his position deteriorated, he became more and more an enemy of the regime, and he had to live out a kind of daily death.
A difficult one indeed. And in fact, this tension between his Stoic philosophy and his life as an advisor to the emperor, that tension is at the heart of your book. And I wonder if, in a nutshell, you could just start us off with describing what was a central dilemma of Seneca's life.
Well, as you say, it's the tension between his role as a moral philosopher, which is how most people think of him. He wrote ethical treatises all throughout his life. He was a devoted adherent of the Stoic creed, meaning that he tried to live a life of moral awareness with an emphasis on reason and the suppression of the passions and ambition. All that would lead him to live out his life in a library, but instead he chose to enter politics and rose to a very high position. As you mentioned, he was advisor to Nero during the first 10 years of his reign, practically ruling the Roman state because Nero was only a teenager at the time he came to power. So he had to live two very contradictory existences. One, a moral philosopher who seemed disinterested in power, and the other, very much a power monger.
You know, one can be a philosopher like Machiavelli and have no contradiction with the machinations of politics, but Stoicism is a very particular kind of philosophy, and I was very interested to learn more about it. I had just the vaguest notion when I started reading your book, Dying Every Day. Tell us a little bit more about Stoicism. I was surprised to find some resonance with Buddhism. Is that completely off the mark?
No, that is very much on the mark. There's practices in Stoicism. In fact, Seneca describes a practice of his own, which is something like Zen meditation, in which he would sit quietly at the end of each day and try to collect his thoughts and to think back on the ways in which he had been untrue to the creed of Stoicism that day. And the creed called for basically living in one's reason as opposed to one's passions or one's desires. For the Stoics, the reasoning faculty in the soul was the seat of the divine. We were each given reason as a sort of gift from the gods or God. The Stoics weren't really clear on what divinity was, but whatever it was manifest in the human soul in reason. So to live through reason is to live in harmony with the divine and to be as happy as humanly possible. External circumstances have nothing to do with happiness for the Stoics. You could be a pauper or you could be a rich man. It didn't make any difference. It was a question of how firmly your reason was at the center of your life.
In fact, there was an emphasis on the simple life and a life in nature, a life without wanting and desires.
Well, there are contradictory positions on that in Stoicism. And I have to deal with this in my book because Seneca was a very rich man. And there was a school of Stoicism in which it wasn't a sin to be rich. In fact, it might even be a mild virtue because you could use your wealth to do good works. However, Seneca's writings take a much harder line and show a disdain for wealth and view it as a corrupting influence on the soul. So here is his greatest contradiction, that he wrote as though to be poor was to be virtuous, and yet he himself was amassing a fortune.
Amassing a fortune because of Nero.
Yes, most of his wealth came from his service to Nero. Some of it, unfortunately, might have come from the estates of people who Nero had assassinated.
And there was a very bloody record there, which we'll get into, but not quite yet, because I'd like to talk about the portraits in stone, the busts of Seneca that you talk about in this book. There's one that I think has come down to us. That was the one that I've always had in mind, a very kind of spare, ascetic-looking individual. And you discovered another one. Tell us about these two busts and where they're from.
So the bust that you refer to shows a man who looks like the ideal image of a philosopher. He's hollow-cheeked. His eyes are gazing out into the eternal. He's what we want a philosopher to be. And when that bust was discovered in the Renaissance, I believe, it was taken to be the image of Seneca. So for centuries, artists and sculptors used that as the basis of their portrayal of Seneca. Then in 1813, another bust was discovered, showing a much more plain-looking man and a man with a full face as though he ate well and liked the high life. And across its chest was written the name Seneca. So now the world knew that this was who Seneca really was. And the other bust has come to be called pseudo-Seneca or false Seneca. And interestingly enough, the Penguin edition of Seneca's letters, which used to feature the real Seneca with his very plain and unimpressive look, has now been replaced by the false Seneca because it's a much more gripping portrait.
So there we go very much to another point in your book, which is all about image making. Talk a little bit about this theme in your book about Seneca.
Yes. So Seneca was a brilliant writer and stylist. He had fantastic control over the Latin language, which is a very supple and subtle language. He was able to spin himself or Nero or whomever he wanted to portray however he wanted, very convincingly, in his prose. And he spun himself most of the time. He was mostly exploring himself in his prose and creating what I think is a very complex, not entirely representational image of himself for his colleagues, his contemporaries, and for posterity. He knew that he had to redeem his reputation through his prose because he'd suffered such damage in his political career.
Why did he have to redeem his reputation?
Well, as Nero became more and more depraved and abhorrent to the political elite of his day, Seneca found himself chained to a monster and unable to get away. He tried on two occasions at least to get away from Nero and was unable because Nero wouldn't release him. So he had to suffer through as the principal advisor, principal adherent of this repugnant young man. So he creates a body of prose that completely omits any mention of Nero or of his own role in the regime, wipes the slate clean of all of that, and instead focuses on his higher aspirations, his philosophical thoughts, as if substituting one Seneca for the other.
So now let's talk about some of the history that you've been alluding to. First of all, tell us a little bit about Seneca and how did he get involved with Nero?
Well, his own reputation as a writer and thinker was what brought him to the highest level of politics. Nero was the heir apparent to the throne at the age of 13. He had no father to speak of. His father had died when he was very young. His mother, Agrippina, very much wanted him to take power, but knew that he needed support and needed moral legitimacy in order to win the hearts of the Roman people. So she brought back Seneca from exile. He was at the time in exile on Corsica on a trumped-up political charge and appointed him as Nero's tutor as a way to bolster the young man's chances of taking power and to make him a more estimable figure. So Seneca, although he was a senator and had some power that way, his principal source of power was by being the steersman, the moral guide to the young emperor.
Now, he had already had a political career that was part of him becoming a senator. He had run into some trouble with a previous emperor, another one that we know of as not a very nice guy. Tell us what happened there.
Well, Seneca's first experience of politics was under Caligula, who, as you say, was an utter madman and sadist and conducted a reign of terror among the political elite, which Seneca witnessed firsthand, and it left very deep scars, as one can tell from his writings, especially the work called De Ira, or On Anger, which was published shortly after Caligula's fall. It was a terrible time to be a senator, and Seneca apparently was in some trouble himself and might have been executed if Caligula had lived longer. But in fact, he survived, and it was only under Claudius, the successor to Caligula, that he fell afoul of the regime and was exiled.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with historian James Rahm about his latest book, Dying Every Day, Seneca at the Court of Nero. I wonder if you could give us a little background right now just about Rome. I mean, we're talking about the first century AD, after the time of Augustus, after the time of Julius Caesar. This was a very widespread empire. But I was wondering, as I was reading your book and reading about the incredible bloodiness of these regimes, you know, if you were a senator, you were basically putting your life on the line, it seemed to me. What was the position of the Roman Empire at this time? Was it actually past its peak?
No, not at all. Its greatest days still lay ahead. The problem for the Roman state was that no one knew exactly what this new office of princeps represented. It was not a king. It was not a hereditary monarchy because the Romans had kicked out their kings centuries before and they thought monarchy was a barbaric institution. They thought the republic was still in force and that the Senate and the consuls still controlled the state. But here was this military strongman, essentially, who had executive power and who had the right or the power to undo anything that the Senate did, even to put senators to death. So it was an unconstitutional office. It was a very poorly defined office. No one knew at any particular point whether it would endure past the time of Augustus. Everyone wanted Augustus to stay in power because he was loved. But after his death, no one was sure whether power would pass to a successor and who that would be. There were terrible problems of legitimacy and authority that continued right on all through the first century AD.
Okay, so Nero comes to the throne, but Nero himself has some problems of legitimacy. What were they? Who else was around him when he came to the throne who posed a threat to him?
Well, Nero's problems stem principally from his lack of popularity. As far as his lineage was concerned, he was the ideal heir. He had the bloodlines on both sides that connected him to Augustus, who was the source of legitimacy, and to a man named Germanicus, who had not ever been princeps, but who had been universally loved by the Romans before his premature death, possibly by assassination. So on two counts, he was a golden boy, and Claudius adopted him, preferring him to his own son, because he could give the regime that much more stability and legitimacy.
But Claudius did have his own son, and that was Britannicus. I found it interesting that Rome itself was founded on the basis of a fratricide, that Romulus killed Remus. Of course, that's in legend. There probably was no such person as Romulus or Remus. But it seemed like that is a legend that resonated way down the centuries to Nero. What happened to Britannicus?
Well, Britannicus, as you say, was the legitimate son of Claudius, the natural son of Claudius, and was thought to be the heir apparent before Nero came on the scene. There were still adherents of Britannicus even after Nero took power. There were some who thought that Britannicus should be on the throne. And the competition between the two of them does have resonance with the days of Romulus and Remus. They were adoptive brothers, not full-blooded brothers, but nevertheless, it had overtones. And the Romans, for a long time, were not sure who would win the rivalry. I show a picture in my book of a coin that has the head of Britannicus on one side and the head of Nero on the other. And I say it's as if the future of the Principate rested on the toss of a coin.
Now, we haven't really talked much about Agrippina, and that is Nero's mother. Wow, what a character she was. Tell us about her.
Well, I'm going to pronounce it Agrippina. Your pronunciation is not wrong, but I prefer Agrippina. Yes, she is an amazing character. She's one of the most savvy and ambitious political power players that the Roman world had seen, either male or female. And the fact that she was female, of course, put her at a huge disadvantage. But she nonetheless found ways to exercise a power that was virtually that of a princeps. First as the wife of Claudius, over whom she had tremendous sway, and then as the mother of Nero. And it seems clear that she got Nero onto the throne principally as a way for her to exercise power through him. And at first, she had practically the power of a co-ruler. There's another coin in the book which shows a remarkable format never before seen at Rome that shows the two profiles of Nero and Agrippina of the same size and stature and facing one another as if they're in a kind of a staring contest or a conversation. It's not clear which, but they're clearly meant to be seen as co-rulers. This was the first coin that Nero issued in his when he came to power at age 16. It was only a year later that Agrippina fell from grace and was virtually exiled or banished from the palace, and her face never appeared on coins again after that.
You have chapters, the first one that deals with Nero's assassination of a family member is called fratricide, and then you have the chapter called matricide. What a story that is, too. Tell us about the relationship between Nero and his mother. It seemed like a very complicated one.
Yes. Agrippina was every adolescent boy's worst nightmare. She was a domineering, controlling, manipulative woman who knew exactly how to push Nero's buttons psychologically and was determined to exercise sway over him, especially in his private life. Their principal disagreements were at first over his sex life, because she wanted him to be loyal to his wife, who she had picked out for him as the perfect mother to the next heir to the throne, and he had other tastes and didn't much like the woman he had married. So they started to disagree, and the conflicts began to grow. There was a long time when things seemed to be in stasis and there wasn't a lot of conflict, but somehow or other, Nero could never rest easy while Agrippina was on the scene. He had to do away with her. And so the climax of the book, as you say, is a chapter called Matricide, where Nero finally assassinates his own mother, not because she provoked him in any particular way, just because he was tormented by her very presence.
And you say they actually may have had a sexual relationship.
It seems so. That's what the ancient sources say, and it's the kind of thing we can never be sure of. And one historian says, if they did, how could anyone have known, and so on and so forth. It's a very difficult question, but it's certainly plausible because she exercised so many other stratagems to get control over him.
And he devised this really bizarre plot against her.
Yes, he wanted to do things cleanly and quietly, away from the eyes of the public. So he devised a trick ship that would fall apart at the push of a lever and presented it to his mother as a gift. It was a beautiful vessel, and had a crew of trained assassins row her out onto a bay and pull the lever and hope that the ship would fall apart and she would be drowned or crushed to death, because part of the trap was a piece of falling lead that was meant to just smash her. Things didn't work out quite as planned. The ship came apart halfway, but still stayed afloat, and Agrippina was able to swim away and get to safety, at least temporarily, while Nero was going completely off his rocker at the thought that his mother had escaped.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with James Rahm about his history and study of the relationship between Seneca and Nero. It's called Dying Every Day. When Nero first ascended to the throne, was there actually a throne?
No, because there was not a monarchy. It's a very awkward thing. But, I mean, there were ceremonial dresses, ceremonial pieces of dress and rings and so on. But there was no actual throne, because that would conjure up kingship, which the Romans didn't like.
But at first they had real hopes for him. And this was where Seneca came in and specifically tried to allay the fears of the Senate. Tell us a little bit about the trajectory of Nero's reign. You know, when did things really start to go horribly wrong between him and everybody else, and why?
The turning point seems to have come around 62, when Nero had become increasingly delusional and self-indulgent. He was spending huge sums of money on his own pleasure and also pursuing a career as a performer, both singing and driving chariots, which was an unheard-of thing for a princeps. And at the same time, his advisors had shifted. He was now listening to people who indulged his worst inclinations, who wanted him to go on the stage, who wanted him to have whatever mad pleasures his heart desired, while Seneca was still trying to restrain him. So Seneca became an enemy, because those who wanted Nero's favor portrayed him as a rival or as a threat. So starting in 62, Nero becomes increasingly devoted to this cadre of those who represented his worst inclinations. In 64, the Senate and part of the military became so disenchanted with Nero that they plotted to kill him. And that plot was revealed in 65 and led to a massive purge. And from that point on, Nero was deeply suspicious and ready to lash out at any opposition.
As you mentioned, going back to the performer, I guess this is the origin of the idea that Nero fiddled while Rome burned. The fire also had something to do with some real disenchantment with Nero. Tell us what happened there, the Great Fire of Rome.
The Great Fire of Rome was in 64, at a time when Nero was already in some disfavor. No one knows whether he had anything to do with it, but rumor painted him as the agent of the fire, as an arsonist, and then went on to depict him playing his lyre and singing a poem about the fall of Troy from his palace walls while watching the fire burn. It's probable that he didn't do that, and it's, to my mind, unprovable that he even had anything to do with the fire, but it created a caricature of a decadent fop who was also terribly dangerous and destructive, and those two things together were a devastating caricature that has endured to this day. That's the first thing most people will think of about Nero, that he fiddled while Rome burned.
When the purge happened, a lot of people got killed, but probably it seems like more people committed suicide. And you spend a fair amount of ink in this book, Dying Every Day, on the subject of suicide. Why would people kill themselves rather than try to escape or just submit to the executioner?
It's a great mystery. The passivity and the compliance of the Roman Senate, both under Caligula and Nero. We have to imagine a state in which the autocrat has total control over military force. Citizens were not allowed to have weapons within the bounds of Rome. Only the Praetorian Guard, which was the emperor's personal security force, totally devoted to his security. So you have a situation somewhat like in a modern North Korea, where there is really no opportunity to stand up to the ruling regime without risking one's life. There's nowhere to run to because the army can track you down anywhere. There's really no way to fight back unless by a kind of massive underground uprising like an assassination conspiracy. And these are the ways that Caligula met his end, and finally the way that Nero met his end. But it took an enormous pressure from the cruelties and abuse of the regime before those things could succeed.
And actually there was a benefit to suicide.
Yes. The emperors had arrived at a system. It was a formalized system whereby a nobleman who had an estate but was suspected of conspiracy or was a threat to the regime could take his own life and then pass on his estate to his heirs. Whereas if he protested or maintained his innocence and had to be executed, the emperor could seize his estate. If you knew you were going to be killed anyway, it was far better to kill yourself and preserve some dignity, preserve the integrity of your body because you wouldn't be decapitated, and your heirs could inherit your estate.
So Seneca himself in his writings had also thought a lot about suicide. Why do you think that's so? I mean, you titled this Dying Every Day. This was something that Seneca thought about not just when he was an old man, not just when he was facing his own ruin, but all the way along. So I wonder if you could kind of give us the nuanced interpretation of suicide in Seneca's life and then talk a little bit about his own.
Yes. Well, Seneca was fascinated by suicide and deaths of every kind. He addressed it first in a work called De Ira on Anger, where he rhapsodizes about suicide as an escape from oppression. He talks first about how despots throughout history have forced good men to knuckle under, do all kinds of terrible things, or accept horrible humiliations. But if you look to suicide as an escape route, these don't have to be painful. You always have freedom at your fingertips, or as he put it, any vein in your body will bring you to freedom. That was his first major meditation on it, but he goes on throughout his career to talk about suicide as a kind of freedom from oppression, a way to regain dignity, to meet one's final crisis in a way that bears out one's ideals. He lionized a man named Cato, who had committed suicide under Julius Caesar so as not to live under an autocracy, in a very dramatic way by disemboweling himself. And Cato, for Seneca and for many Romans, was the ideal Stoic hero. So Seneca, when he came to a point where he knew that Nero was determined to exterminate him and he would eventually have to make the same choice himself, he started to plot his own suicide. And when he finally had a chance to carry it out, he had elaborate plans, none of which came to fruition quite the way he expected. And it's a long and agonizing scene involving three different methods, but he finally did succeed in killing himself without Nero having to execute him.
I'd actually like to ask you something I could have asked you in the beginning, but I would rather ask you now, which is, why did you decide to write about Seneca? And then to follow that up, did you solve the riddle that you had set for yourself in the beginning?
Well, there was the riddle that first really drew me, the seeming contradictions between the word and the deed, between the politician and the philosopher. And I knew it was going to be a damned hard puzzle, and that intrigued me. I wanted to work on something really challenging and difficult, and where there was a lot of material, because Seneca's writings are voluminous, and the writings of people like Tacitus, who portrayed him in their writings. So I had a lot to work with. I don't, in the end, think that I solved any puzzle. I think I'm still as bewildered as ever. But I've come to understand better the complexity of human nature, that we live with these contradictions. In his case, they're more egregious than in most, but all of us have contradictions between word and deed, or between our ideals for ourselves and our reality. And it's part of the mystery of human character that we can live with two different selves, each of which doesn't really have any contact with the other.
Do you feel that Rome is better for Seneca having been part of it?
Oh, no question. The first 5 years of Nero's reign, the Quinquennium Neronis, as they came to be called, were judged to be the high water mark of the whole Roman Empire by some interpreters. That might have only been 1 or 2 years if Seneca hadn't been on the scene. Seneca kept Nero on track, kept him from following his worst impulses for 5 long years.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and you tell it very well in Dying Every Day. James Rahm, I want to thank you very much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
James Rahm is professor of classics at Bard College. He's the author of 5 books, including Ghost on the Throne. Read an excerpt from Dying Every Day at writersvoice.net. Next up, we visit the world of the 99% of ancient Rome. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. All too often, history only tells the story of the 1%, while ordinary people are left out. What survives from the Roman Empire is largely the words and lives of the rich and powerful. But the privilege and decadence associated with the Roman elite was underpinned by the toils and struggles of common citizens. In his book, Invisible Romans, historian Robert Knapp brings those ordinary people of ancient Rome to light, its laborers, artisans, housewives, and slaves, among others. Knapp celebrates the resilience of those who had to survive and try to thrive despite oppression and class injustice. invisible Romans reveals what Knapp called the mind world of the ordinary Roman, one that, while unique to its time, nevertheless has some remarkable parallels to our own day.
I could see some parallels as well, and not the least of which is a dysfunctional elite.
Right. Well, actually, before we go into the ordinary Romans, would you like to say something about the dysfunctional elite?
Well, I think that when you have a class that is what we would say independently wealthy, and therefore have as a programmatic desire a lot of time on their hands, and then they tend to go off the rails in various ways, both politically and socially, because they can, because there's really no constraint on what they do. In the politics of Rome, of course, there was the constraint of power, and the emperor and his entourage controlled most of that power. But outside that very small circle, if you were wealthy, you could pretty much do anything that you wanted to do. And sometimes that was thoughtful, such as Seneca, and sometimes that was roguish, such as Nero and various elites in the way they handled their slaves, for example. The biggest distinction between my people and the elite is that my people actually have to work for a living day in and day out, and that informs how they view the world and the strategies they use and so on in a very different way than the leisure-centered life that the elite lived.
One difference we could say is there was no actual illusion of upward mobility. It was a pretty hierarchically structured society. Tell us about the class structure of ancient Rome.
Well, the class structure of ancient Rome, like all pre-industrial societies, is heavily stratified. So the wealth concentrates at the top and then is distributed very unevenly on down the pyramid. And the old saying, them's that got or them's that get, is very true in a stratified society. It's very difficult to acquire the resources when you're further down the pyramid to move into a class, a stratum, that's higher up the pyramid. In the Roman world, one of the fastest ways to become wealthy was to be on the right side in a political dispute, because then the winners of a political dispute in a civil war could redistribute all the wealth, and then another group of people gets to the top. But that would never affect the 99%. Now, that said, within the 99%, there is a certain amount of mobility, because the divisions in the hierarchy and the strata of the 99% are not nearly as defined and nearly as hardened as the distinction between the very most wealthy and everybody else. At the bottom, where you have the very poor, then yes, it would be very difficult for them to acquire the capital that would be necessary to lead a more self-sustained life. But in the middle group, say 40% or so of the population, then it was possible to improve yourself, to go from a small farmer to a large farmer, from a small merchant to a large merchant. That was entirely possible.
And even some slaves were able to make it into a higher status.
Well, the situation of the slaves is very interesting. I think of it in two of a slave possibilities in two different ways. One is within slavery, where the slaves provide the expertise and the labor that allows the large establishments of the elites to function. And so a slave within that situation could actually become very valuable because of his or her skills and therefore be treated very well within that slave environment. So that's one sort of aspiration that a slave in a household could have. The other aspiration, which is consistent through all the material I saw, was the aspiration to freedom. Not freedom for everybody. There is no ideology of universal emancipation or the abolition of slavery. But on an individual basis, then you hear time and again of the desires of slaves to become free. When this happened, it usually happened when they were around 30 years old. And so they had an opportunity to use the skills they had acquired as slaves to establish businesses on their own outside of slavery, and they often did, and this produces the freedman class, which was one of the most dynamic mercantile classes in the empire. So you had this dual possibility for slaves within slavery, if you could show that you had talents that were extremely valuable to your master. And outside of slavery, once you gained your freedom, you might have skills that allowed you to be successful. Of course, the mass of slaves would not experience either of these things. They would live and die in slavery in terrible conditions or in not-so-terrible conditions, but freedom would not be part of their lives.
I'd like to come back to slaves a little bit later, but just for now, I'd like to continue laying out some of the broad strokes of the mind world, as you call it, the mind world of the ancient Romans. And first of all, just tell us, what do you mean by the mind world?
What I tried to capture with that term was, how do these ordinary Romans think about the world around them? How do they conceptualize what their hopes and fears are, their possibilities, their rivalries? Not so much, you know, X percent of people in Rome are bricklayers and Y percent are water carriers, but rather, how did they deal with life as they found it? This really fascinates me because it tells you a lot more about people than descriptions of industry or what kind of goods people sold and so on. So that's what I think of when I speak of, when I write of their mind world. How do they think about the world around them in terms of challenges and goals and that sort of thing?
And one way that you explore is superstition, magic, dream interpretation. Talk about the role that these played in Roman society and why they were so important.
Well, we have to think of a world which is entirely impregnated with the supernatural. That is to say, the natural, as we think of the natural and the supernatural, are one. So it's not a question of, oh, I live in the natural world, how am I going to communicate with the supernatural world? But it's a situation in which the two live together in everyday life. So you want to be able to maximize the possibilities of the supernatural just as you would maximize the possibilities of the natural world. And you do this in a variety of ways. You do this through sacrifice. You do this through prayer. You do this through magic. You do this through trying to see what the supernatural universe is telling you through the stars, which is what astrology is all about. All of these are ways to interact with the supernatural world that is literally a part of your life, not something apart from the rest of your life. So everybody in the Roman world felt this way, not the elites and the non-elites. You have a few outliers of sort of crazy philosophers who think otherwise, but they never have any influence in the general population, as influential as some of their thinking is down through the centuries. So when people had a problem, say a health problem, then their automatic solutions are two. One is in the natural world, which you go out and find roots or berries or whatever your grandmother told you was going to cure what you have. And you also interact with what we call the supernatural world through magic, for example, or through prayers or through votive offerings, sacrifice, to enlist that other part of your existence in dealing with the illness that you have. So it's a completely integrated system, which is foreign to us because we think of the two, the supernatural and the natural, as two distinct areas. And miracles, for example, is coming somehow from outside the natural experience and affecting change. Whereas for the ancients, a miracle would simply be, you know, like taking chicken broth. It would just be another possibility for curing some ill that you might have.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with historian Robert Knapp about his book, Invisible Romans. In it, he describes how lawsuits were a common feature of ancient Rome. I asked him why Romans were so litigious, and was this peculiar to their society?
Any society with rules has the strong potential of becoming litigious because who's applying the rules, how they're applying the rules, what the rules are, always raises controversy. So it's nothing peculiar to the Romans. Now, that said, in my view, Roman law has gotten very much an elite tilt to it. And the glorification of Roman law often ignores the fact that it was a tool of the elite. Common people, ordinary people, try to avoid the courts as much as possible. Why? Because they're expensive. You have to hire a lawyer in order to deal with the intricacies of the law courts. They are prejudiced. Wealthy people are very much more likely to win a law case against a non-wealthy person just because they have the connections that are necessary, the knowledge that are that's necessary, the money that's necessary. You avoid them because not only do you have to pay for a lawyer, but you usually have to go to some fair distance, disrupt your entire life, leave your farm, leave your business, to sit around some magistrate's court, not knowing whether they're going to show up, not knowing how long this process is going to take, really cutting into your normal life's cycle. So there are lots of inhibitors for the ordinary person to take advantage of the legal system. And the preferred method of problem solving is therefore informal. Within a religious group, for example, within the synagogue, if you happen to be Jewish, you would perhaps seek resolution from a council or from some other process within that group. If you were in a trade association, perhaps you would try to find resolution there. So the legal system is not something that ordinary Romans would think of as a first go-to. They would think of it as something to avoid, whereas the elite, who make the laws and make them in their favor, do tend to spend much more time in actual active litigation.
Well, as you point out in the book, as we've been saying, there were a lot of laws, but there was also a lot of violence, and violence was a very accepted part of normal everyday life. Do you think, again, that this was just something that was common to the ancient world, or do you think the Romans were more practitioners of violence than most?
It's absolutely common to the ancient world. The thing we have to get our heads around is that there is no effective police force anywhere, at any time, in our sense of an effective police force in the ancient world. There are people who are responsible for keeping public order if something really serious breaks out, like a riot or something like that. But short of that, you and your neighbors are pretty much on your own. So if your house is broken into, for example, your recourse is going to be to shout out to your neighbors, to scream to them, you know, I'm being robbed. And then they will rush to your assistance. But there isn't a policeman on the block that's going to help you. So in this vacuum of organized police, this lack of organized police activity, then not only do, you know, thugs and criminals resort to violence, but also it's a pretty wide open opportunity for individuals. I would compare this to the American frontier, where there was practically no law enforcement. And what happened was individual citizens took law into their own hands. They formed vigilante groups. They pretty much used violence to, you know, expel people that they didn't like, such as Mormons or free blacks or whatever. And that was just the way that life was on the frontier. So in the ancient world, you have this same sort of situation where violence is a recourse because there is no other control of antisocial, or very little other control of antisocial behavior. Now, I don't want to leave the impression that everybody walking down the street is going to be in danger of being knocked over the head and robbed. That clearly is not the case. But it is the case that you didn't go out at night, for example, without a group of men with you. Certainly you didn't go out as a woman at all. You didn't travel any distance in the country with any quantity of money. And if you did, you traveled with an entourage. It was just a reality that was universal, and indeed was universal in Europe until the middle of the 19th century. Part of what we're thinking about is it's not really so odd. What our world is odd. in terms of history, not the ancient world.
Yeah, you mentioned women. The position of women, as is, you know, shown in your book, Invisible Romans, Robert Knapp, the position of women was quite subservient, and in many ways it seemed like the notions of womanhood and women's place sound not that much different from the attitudes that were prevalent in this country before the women's liberation movement. I mean, the idea of the role of the woman and how she's got to, you know, serve her man. And women were also subjected to a lot of domestic violence, and yet there were some surprises, too, about the economic strength and power of women in the household, ordinary women.
Exactly. And I was intrigued with thinking about women in this environment, particularly because in the literature on elite women that's come out since the 70s, there's been a lot of emphasis on liberated women and how they actually had more activities and more intellectual work and so on than we had thought before, which is all very true for the elite, where leisure is a possibility. But my question was, how about ordinary women? What are they doing? And this is where my idea of mind world really intrigued me, because when I realized, not surprisingly, given pre-industrial societies, that women's place was very static, was in many ways subservient to the male role in the family, not to mention in public life. The question is, how did women feel about this? And the answer that I settled upon was that they adjusted to this situation. That is, there's no indication of pulling against the bit on this. They make the most of what situation they are in, without complaint, without realizing this is what they're doing, but just that's what their mind world is. It's focused on family, and it's focused on contributing to the household. And that's where their role is most important. You can't have a family of ordinary people where the woman isn't doing anything. She's a crucial partner in this family. She's not shut away. She's not treated as a trophy or as an ornament. She is an active and important part of everyday life in the family. This doesn't mean that she's not going to be abused at various times. This doesn't mean that she's not going to be taken advantage of. But it does mean that, I believe, ordinary women were able to find satisfaction in their very important roles as an element in a successful household, an active element in a successful household and family.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with historian Robert Knapp about his book, Invisible Romans. Now, we spoke some about slavery. I'd like to ask you a little bit more about slavery. First of all, how was it different, slavery in ancient Rome, how was it different than slavery in the 19th century slave trade?
I think there are at least two fundamental differences. The first I mentioned briefly before, that is, there's no ideology of emancipation. There's no ideology of abolition of slavery. So the world that slaves are living in is a world of acceptance of the institution. So their mind world involves dealing as best they can with that situation. So that's one aspect of their slavery. The other aspect that I focus on is how they maximize their possibilities. And they do this by living in a slave community that has its own ideas, has its own rules, has its own leaders, and works in some sense together. Now, it's very different from American slavery because, as I say, there's no idea of emancipation, so there's no hope out there that this is all going to go away at some point. You've got to deal with it in real time. And there is no somatic difference between the slaves and their masters. In the New World, in New World slavery, the fact that most slaves are black skin color sets them apart, and that makes it's a signal that these people are different than us, than the white people. In the ancient world, although there are some blacks, it's a very small number. It's not a consequential part of slavery. Most everybody in slavery looks like the people that aren't in slavery. So it's much easier to move from being a slave to being freed to being part of the regular society than it could possibly ever possibly be in the deeply paranoid situation that black slavery created in the minds of whites in the southern United States.
And how does one become a slave in ancient Rome?
Well, that's not a happy situation. In the earlier part of Roman history, in their wars of conquest, they enslaved tens of thousands of people, because if you lose in a war or in a battle, if your city is defeated, you literally become the property of the people that conquered you. And the conquerors then can do anything they want. They can put you back where you were before with no harm. They can demand a huge ransom. They can and they can enslave you. So in the early period, mostly it was prisoners of war. But as the empire progresses, there is less and less of this conquest, and the gap is filled by people kidnapping on a broad scale, kidnapping people, taking them to centers of the slave trade, Delphi or Ephesus, and selling them. Nobody asking any questions about where these people came from. So that feeds the slave trade in large measure. That and, of course, the general increase from slaves that are born into slavery. So kidnapping, pirates were big on this, was a very large source of slavery, and people feared that that this would happen. The third way that it was supplied was if you had a child and didn't want it, then you would expose this child. You'd set it out on a dung heap somewhere, and people would be watching for this, and they would snatch up the child, raise the child in slavery.
Was there anything that you were really surprised by in when you were researching and writing this book, Invisible Romans?
I think in working with the slaves and with the women, the realization that how people dealt with where they were, this only gradually dawned on me as I read more and more. And it was, for me, a very important realization that I hope I got across in the book.
So you really discovered the resilience of people, the 99%, some of whom, like slaves and women and prostitutes and the gladiators, who we haven't had time to talk about, that they had some real resilience in responding to the difficult circumstances of their lives.
Well, you know, that's the perfect word. I think resilience is the perfect word. The general resilience, yes, that was very striking.
Robert Knapp. He's professor emeritus in the classics department at the University of California, Berkeley. His book is Invisible Romans. Go to writersvoice.net to read an essay by Knapp comparing the Invisible Romans to the Occupy movement's 99%. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.